Welcome to All About Business with me, James Reed, the podcast that covers everything about business, management, and leadership. In a world where hustle culture is the norm, and 45% of small business owners are suffering from burnout, is maximizing productivity really the only way to build a successful business? Today's guest, Tom Hodgkinson, believes idleness is key to creating a life and business that's truly fulfilling. He's the founder and editor-in-chief of The Idler magazine, where he encourages his readers to slow down, have fun, and live well. In this episode, we discuss the idler philosophy, how to turn your passion into a business, and why the world's most successful entrepreneurs embrace idleness. I'm really delighted to welcome Tom Hodgkinson. Tom is going to have a lot to say about the subject of idling. He's written several books on the theme, one called How to Be Idle, another The Idle Parent. Tom is an avowed, self-avowed anarchist. I think he's the first anarchist on our show. And he's also an entrepreneur, publisher, and he runs an academy, the Idler Academy, with his partner, Victoria. So idling is your big theme. You're wearing, for those who can't see, a T-shirt with a wonderful red snail on it. Tom, the question on my mind that sort of just I can't get out of my head to start with, I want to understand this philosophy, but the question on my mind is there a difference between idling, as you call it, and just being lazy, frankly?
There are loads of synonyms for lazing around, loafing, lollygagging and so on. But I felt that idling as a word, or idler, had positive feeling about it, actually. It's a decision that you take. You know, you don't want to be caught up in the rat race full time. You want to kind of slow down a bit. You want to take some control over your time. And idling could mean something like doing your own thing, or idling could mean a kind of a freedom to do something that you want to do. So in a paradoxical way, as you know, in kind of embracing idling, people often become quite busy. In my case, I didn't really feel I kind of suited the more conventional world of work. So my option was to become some sort of a freelancer or start my own business. Well, of course, both of those things also have their pressures and worries, and you might end up, you know, working pretty hard. But for
in pursuit of idleness, you have become busy.
Not too busy.
When I think of the word idling, you see little signs around saying no idling. But I think that's to do with engines running in the street. But an engine that's idling is about to go forward, isn't it?
It can go forward. It's taking a rest. You know, it's an important part of. For me, idling is a very, very important part of life that we've essentially neglected, you know, particularly over the last 200 years. In most older cultures, you know, the religious culture actually provides idling, days off, bank holidays, feast days, festivals, and so on. You know, time in church, mosque, or, you know, synagogue, or whatever it is.
So praying is a form of idling, is it?
I think praying is definitely a form of idling, absolutely. And I think, you know, contemplation is a form of idling. You know, what we now call mindfulness or meditation is a form of idling. It's a chance to sort of get off the treadmill, escape the sort of pressures of things like status and money and all the things that the so-called sort of real world imposes on us.
Well, I like work, but that's why I want to explore this subject.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because actually work is a really weird word, isn't it? Like, what does it actually mean? There's work, there's play, are they opposites? Is work something that you don't want to do? Or could you turn work into something that you do want to do? That's what I've attempted to do anyway. I saw work as something I didn't particularly want to do, but I had to do for money. You know, so in that situation, you either sort of perhaps, you know, change your mindset so that you enjoy your job, you change your job, or change your whole situation and maybe do the thing you really want to do, which in my case was, you know, journalism, book writing, and to start my own magazine.
Right. So, I mean, you talk about working for money. I mean, everyone needs to earn a living. The aristocratic ideal, I think, was sort of founded on sort of other people working and them sitting in large houses.
The idle rich.
Yeah, the idle rich. But, I mean, that's not what you're talking about here, is it?
No, because that's obviously only open to a few people. And in any case, that's in many cases immoral, I think. You know, a lot of fortunes have been built on, well, quite recently on slavery, you know, more recently on exploitation of people in factories. Before that, well, Henry VIII stole land and buildings from the church and gave them to his mates, you know, and then they were able to live off the rent. That's not really what I'm talking about. So living off, as you said, living off the toil of other people. Right. I don't think that's really kind of what...
That's not the type of idling you're commending to us.
No, but I think you could be a little sort of mini aristocrat in your own... Just by
doing... Right, so how do you do this? Well, yeah. So you're not going to do immoral idling, you know, like these people you've been describing, Henry VIII and his ilk, but you want to find a life where you have more time.
Yeah.
And you're calling it an idle life, maybe. How do you accomplish that as someone living now in 2025?
There are all sorts of little moments in the day, I think, that you can sort of grab. Now, lots of people, for example, have a lunch break. Well, in America, I know, you know, in some companies, it's sort of frowned upon to go out at your lunch break because you're supposed to be sort of working really hard. But I think that's a quick thing to do to sort of reclaim your lunch break. And actually, an hour is quite a lot of idling time. When I used to work in High Hoban at the Sunday Mirror magazine, which is very near where we are now, you know, I would go out at my lunch break, wander around the church, sit on a park bench, probably have a little bit of a doze, you know, read some poetry, eat my sandwich. And that was quite sort of blissful, I felt.
Do you ever get moved on?
Well, yeah, there is this prejudice against hanging around doing nothing.
Yeah, there is. That's
loitering
what I was like.
With intent.
That's a crime or an offence.
Yeah, it's a crime. Like, you know, it's like, stop sitting still, like, do something. You know?
Yeah. Get on with your day. So you're encouraging people to lie on benches.
Absolutely, yeah. Okay. As long as you're not stopping someone else from
sitting on
bench.
It, which would be discourteous, yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So tell me about your journey. How did you start out in your career and what drew you in this direction? I mean, what put you off, you know, a conventional route, maybe doing a graduate scheme at a major law firm, as you just described, into this more sort of esoteric career choice?
I really kind of went into the family business because both my parents were Fleet Street hacks. So they both did well in Fleet Street.
So journalists.
Journalists. When it was really sort of thriving, you know, they worked at the places like the Mirror Group, Sunday People, Daily Mail.
Well, those were good jobs back in the day when newspapers carried a lot of advertising, weren't they?
Absolutely. They were great jobs. They were very well paid. They weren't too hard work. My mum had a four-day week, you know. They were in the pub half the time, but they made loads. And my parents gradually started doing better in their own lives. And therefore, my brother and I were taken out of the state schools when we were quite young and put into prep schools. And, you know, we became sort of posher than my parents, really. And I went to a school called Westminster and then went to Oxbridge, Jesus College, Cambridge, did English. So it was a really sort of like, you know, sophisticated education, which I very much enjoyed. And I enjoyed the academic side. But I also had this other thing at our school. It was quite cool to be sort of punky, you know. So we were fans of The Clash, Sex Pistols, Joy Division. We used to love going to gigs. So living in London as a sort of 14-year-old public school boy, you know, you actually got this sort of influence of underground music. And I also enjoyed the philosophy at school. So there were these two things kind of combining. And then I played in punk bands at university. A lot of the punk bands that we liked ran their own record labels, you know. And I thought that was quite an impressive, like, small business, taking...
Rough Trade.
Well, then I went on to work for Rough Trade.
You worked for Rough Trade?
Shop. Yeah.
I remember Rough Trade being one of the labels.
Yeah, that's the label. But they also had a shop. And
was it in Portobello?
In Portobello Road.
That's what I remember it, yeah.
Yeah, and it's still there. In fact, they've expanded. They've got a big one in Brick Lane. I spent a year there, and they also had a skateboarding shop. And the people I met there were very entrepreneurial, you know, they were sort of very creative. They were running fanzines, putting on club nights, I don't know, you know, playing in bands, designing T-shirts, starting up skateboard labels.
Then what happened after that?
Well, you know, I found the people who ran Rough Trade actually quite inspiring, Pete and Nigel. Nigel still runs it. It was their own business that they wanted to run. So I ended up with this weird mix of wanting to start my own business and also sit around doing nothing.
That is quite difficult.
It's quite hard. Impossible, I would say. But then I got a job at the Sunday Mirror, where on magazine, and I was there for 2 years. That was 1990, a long time ago. Alistair Campbell was the political editor at the Daily Mirror, to give you an idea of how long ago it was. It was still owned by Maxwell. And that was... sort of started as 3 days a week, then I did 5 days a week, very junior position as a kind of researcher. I didn't like it particularly because I was too snooty. I wanted to be sort of writing about romantic poetry, you know, but it was very good training, actually, very good magazine training for 2 or 3 years. Then I was sacked. And at this point...
Well, I must ask, why were you sacked? You remember?
They just said, oh, we're sort of cutting down on stuff. I was kind of a freelancer, so I didn't have a proper contract or anything, you know. And then so I was on the dole and in a way sort of free to do my magazine project. I've been turning it over in my mind probably for 2 years, The Idler.
We're delighted that you're listening to this episode. Hit the follow button so that we can continue to bring you the best business insight and actionable advice
to help your business and or career.
So you decided to start a magazine?
Yeah, and I went to see my friend Gav.
How did you finance that? How did you set that?
Well, the finance, essentially, it cost 800 quid
right.
In 1993.
To get a whole magazine published?
To print 1,000 copies, yeah, and do the reproduction and the sort of necessary things that we had to do. My friend Gav had a computer. He had an Apple Mac, so that was okay. We did it in his flat, in his back room. And that money came from lifetime subscribers, you know, a bit of money from my mum, maybe.
Friends and family,
you know, 50 quid here, 100 quid there. I think actually we got £790, and then my friend Gav's girlfriend gave us the last tenner. And then I went and sold it, literally got on my bicycle.
Did you sell enough to cover the cost?
Well, we did. I think we sold just about enough, and we got some good publicity too. With my friend Claire, who's now very senior at The Guardian, I went around all the newspapers dropping a copy off.
Right.
And we got some good publicity in the Daily Telegraph, for example.
Right.
Gav and I went on a radio show. So it started quite well. We got a little bit of coverage.
So that was your initial business?
And that was, but that, I wasn't really expecting it to make any money. In fact, it didn't make any money for the next 27 years.
Right.
But it led to lots of other stuff.
Oh, okay. So that sort of, that was the initiator. So what other things did you do after that then?
Freelancing for all sorts of newspapers and magazines, Vogue and The Independent and stuff. And after publishing for about a year or two, I think we'd printed about 4 or 5 copies. The Guardian marketing department sort of picked up on it and brought us into the Guardian fold.
Right.
And we stayed there for 3 years. And in fact, we ended up running a department, special ideas department there.
Right. Okay. So you've done sort of collaborations. So how many editions of The Idler have there been now? You've got the latest one behind you. I can see it's got Michael Palin on the cover.
Yeah.
What number is that?
That's 103.
Number 103.
Unbelievably, yeah.
Unbelievably. So that's been going very consistently. But then you've added to it, you've started this academy.
Yeah.
With courses, and you also do trips for fellow idlers to have idling experiences.
Victoria and I, my partner, and our 3 small children moved to North Devon for 12 years. And that's where I kind of wrote most of my books. And while we were there, we had this idea of an idler academy. So like Plato's academy any kind of academy. And we all know how frequently that word is used. It comes from the groves of Academe. You know, it was the area outside of Athens where Plato first taught his students in one of the first philosophical schools. And that was a real inspiration for me, the ancient Greek philosophers.
Is that the word means? Okay.
Yeah, that's where it comes from, yeah.
Oh, right.
And, you know, Aristotle had his Lyceum,
right,
which was also in Athens. And Epicurus started his own school, which was called the Garden, also near Athens. The Stoics taught in the marketplace. And it was an amazing period where there were several philosophical schools, all inspired by Socrates, and all saying to people, look, you really need to take more time for leisure, whoever you are.
Was this before Greek culture disappeared? Or was it?
It was.
Or was it its heyday?
Yeah, this was sort of...
It wasn't before the Romans occupied them, was it?
It was a bit earlier. It was like 3rd to 5th century. It was an absolute heyday.
Heyday.
You know? Yeah, and it was when the famous Greek playwrights were operating, you know, Aristophanes, whatever, the Greek tragic playwrights. An amazing period in Athens, 100,000 people, a self-governing city, you know. And the philosophers were saying, but people were anxious too, as we are today. So there was a lot of anxiety around, and they were perpetually at war with Sparta, for example. And it was a kind of warlike culture. It was very dynamic, and they built incredible things like the Parthenon, you know, during that period. But there was a level of anxiety. The philosophers came along and started teaching people how to become less anxious.
That's interesting.
And it's like...
Stoic philosophy is quite in vogue these days. There's lots of...
Well, Stoic philosophy is amazing. I just finished writing a book about it.
Why is it amazing? What's good about it? Give us a quick heads up.
The basic principle that everyone will quote is you can't control external events, but you can control your reactions to those events.
Yes.
So if something bad happens, you know, is it all in the mind? So if something bad could happen, but it's only bad if you allow it to, if you allow yourself to think it's bad. I mean, it's a tall order. It's a very, very tall order. But the Stoics say, you know, even when I'm being tortured on the rack, I remain happy. It's only my mind that says this is a bad thing. They say that, you know, I can remain happy if my children die, my wife dies, if I lose all my money, if I lose my job, you know, whatever it is. So they're saying that happiness comes from within.
So is your sort of idling or idler philosophies are quite aligned with this Stoicism, do you feel? Or is it is that something different you've just
described? Well, I think Stoics, yeah, a little bit, but I think it's actually a bit joyless.
And the Stoic side of
it. Yeah, thing. Lacking in fun.
Yeah, which, I can imagine sort of Puritans identifying with that to an extent.
I think they liked it.
Did they? But you're not keen on Puritanism by the side. You've already had a go at Henry VIII.
Yeah. Well,
he wasn't a Puritan, was he? But he sort of...
No, he wasn't, but he was...
Precursor
he sort of
to them.
Set the stage for it, because... when I was writing my books, I read a lot of medieval history and started to realise that a lot of us have this sort of caricature of the Middle Ages, which is like everyone was kind of a leper and, you know, living in mud huts and very unsophisticated. There was no science. People were superstitious and so on. But actually, it wasn't anything like as much as the Dark Ages as people say. It was much less Monty Pythonish than we think. A lot of fun, you know. It was quite a sort of merry culture. We have this idea of Merry England. And I grew up with people saying, oh, Merry England was a myth, you know, the sort of time before Henry VIII. But historians I've read recently, you know, contemporary historians, you know, professors, not crazy people, say that, well, actually, the late Middle Ages particularly, there was a lot of fun and dancing, maypoles, boozing. The church encouraged it. They wanted people to enjoy themselves.
Why did they encourage it?
They encouraged it because it bonded communities. Also, it raised money. So they sold the beer. So
There you go. They ran the breweries.
It's like rave culture. Instead of cracking down on rave culture, let's put the raves on. Then we can make the money. And I think they thought
made the wine, the beer, and they profited from it. But people were happy, you're saying.
People were happy. Maybe there was a blowing off tensions as well. I don't know, you know. And then
so Merry England was real, was it?
Merry England was real. And
you're trying to recreate it. So
there's elements of it that are really fun to bring back with you know, guilt-free versions, you know, big feasts. Funnily enough, pilgrimage is coming back. A lot of these medieval customs, I think, are coming back in again.
Pilgrimages?
Pilgrimage, yeah.
Really?
People going on large groups. Because pilgrimage was also banned by the Puritans. But the thing that's particularly, I suppose, relevant to the idler and James, to what you do as well at Reed, was this idea of how kind of work ethic, you know, appeared.
Tell me about that. How did that appear?
Well, very briefly, you know, like we have an image of Puritans in black hats. There's a Puritan in Shakespeare called Malvolio in Twelfth Night, and he's priggish, self-important. And crucially, the new Puritans, who felt that the church had become corrupt, you know, priests were selling indulgences and all that sort of thing. The clerics were, you know, feathering their own nests, and it had just got hopelessly out of hand and totally lost touch with the real original idea behind Christianity. Calvin and Luther, you know. So Calvin and Luther ushered in a new sort of era, and they were very keen on work in a way that the medieval people had. You know, obviously, they worked, they made things, and, you know, but work wasn't, it was less of a sort of a cult or a religion.
They elevated
work, and they made it close to kind of godliness.
Why did they do that? What's the thinking behind that?
Well, I think partly they did it because it went hand in hand with, well, it was kind of an individualism, actually. They didn't like being told what to do. Like, there were people at the time who said, why should I, how come I'm not allowed to fight on a Monday? Why do I have to go to these feast days? But also it was very much a religious thing, because they considered these attitudes to be popish and superstitious and sort of old-fashioned. So they wiped out all those feast days. You know, Christmas was sort of nearly banned. It was certainly banned in Boston, and they tried to ban it under Cromwell a bit later. So there was an attack on the festive culture. But also they thought that the festive culture, you know, led people to getting drunk, fornicating, having children out of wedlock, and therefore those people were going straight to hell. But if you essentially got people onto the straight and narrow, working hard, turning up on time, avoiding enjoying themselves too much, you know, life became a more serious business, I think, more or less. And it's a very complicated series of reformations, counter-reformations. And eventually those Puritans, as we know, sailed off to America with their black hats.
Well, I was just thinking about that. The Mayflower was a ship of Plymouth Brethren, wasn't it? Yeah, that went to America with those ideas, or took those ideas to America.
They took those ideas to America, and
it's
been an amazing success, hasn't it? I mean, an incredibly sort of dynamic culture.
If the Merry England crowd had gone, do you think it would have been the same?
No, the Merry England crowd, they still would have been sort of like dancing around a maypole and passing out in a ditch.
So there is something. So this culture that emerged with the black-hatted Puritans that you described still pervades the way we view a lot of things today. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, and I think the Industrial Revolution came along after that too, and that also accelerated this whole thing. So technology extended the working hours because we had light bulbs. New machines came in which could work 24/7. So that meant that the working day should be extended. So the medieval people, they had this, you know, there wasn't any electric light, obviously. And they were actually against overwork because it might give you it was a more collective, cooperative culture, largely speaking. I'm slightly generalizing. I know it was much more complicated. We're talking about 500 years, but generally speaking, you know, you had a guild system of business. And the guilds were like a sort of a union, but they also owned the means of production. And they fixed the prices and they limited the working hours, a bit like a union might do today. Because if you worked, well, you're not supposed to work, it might give you an unfair advantage over your brother in the guild. Or if you work by candlelight, you know, you produce inferior materials and things right. Were obviously less mechanized, you know. So, but the machines, if you've invested £1 million in a machine or whatever it is, then you want to get maximum productivity out of it. Hence very long working days in the early 19th century and women and children working. And also the migration from, you know, from countryside to town, because the new machines needed lots of people to work on them.
Well, I was thinking when you were saying that, the sort of communal rural society in the Middle Ages, there wouldn't have been a lot of work to do in the winter because you harvested the crops, you plant them in the spring, you know, make merry in the winter, perhaps, and have big festival, 12 days of Christmas. And
absolutely.
All
that. It was a natural time to have a festival. Yeah.
Yeah. So that I can see there was a pattern to life that these innovations disrupted. And we're now getting new innovations that are likely to disrupt us again, especially, you know, this AI revolution that's right upon us. Can you see anything in history that might reassure us about what's coming next? Or are we going to be working even harder in this new world of AI, or are we not going to be working at all? Some people are saying there won't be any jobs left. What do you think about this?
I think there needs to be a good balance. Thinking about AI, it's hard to predict. Although I will make a prediction, which is that it's not going to be anything like as good or bad as people are saying. It's going to be something in the middle. I'm indifferent. You know, we've had this before. You know, I remember 6 years ago, everyone was talking about the robots are coming. In the 70s, people were talking about this amazing amount of leisure that we were going to have. What would we do with it all? Because machines become more sophisticated, the working day gets shorter. So I don't think AI... I mean, clearly AI is affecting some jobs. It's not going to take them all away. AI can't build a house, you know. I mean, there are certain obvious things that it simply can't do. Again, in the Industrial Revolution, there was this idea that the machines would do all the work, but somehow it doesn't seem to end up like that. Under the conditions of, you know, capitalism or whatever you call it, actually, the working day got longer. Shouldn't, you know, if you have new technology, shouldn't we sort of as a collective think, well, that's great, now we only have to work 30 hours a week? I did a diary story in The Idler about Sergey Brin, you know, the founder of Google. And you would have thought that he might be giving himself a little bit of time off now. I mean, he's probably nearly 60. He started one of the biggest companies in the world. It turns over $250 billion a year in advertising sales, you know. I mean, he's made an absolute fortune. But because they want to compete with AI, he's running a new AI department, and he keeps sending memos to his staff to encourage them to work harder and harder, sleep under the desk and this sort of thing. So, you know, that's the work ethic, I think, sort of gone a bit crazy. There were philosophers in the 30s who were like John Maynard Keynes, the economist, you know. They thought we were working too hard then, and that a sane society would come down to just very slowly, gradually reduce the working week, which has happened, you know.
Didn't Bertrand Russell have a view about this?
And Bertrand Russell definitely
agreed.
What
was his thing?
Well, he wrote an essay called In Praise of Idleness, which, you know. In Praise of Idleness, yeah.
All right.
Because he says that work in itself is not good, you know. So we say, hard work is good, but hard work is not necessarily good, because you could be working very hard for something bad. You could be working very hard selling heroin. I mean, you could be working very hard as a. I mean, I hope that's not a glib example, but you know, the Nazis worked hard. I mean, you know, so just working hard itself, torturers work hard, you know. And you might be working hard doing something that's immoral. So I think he was saying that, you know, work itself is not a moral good.
Didn't he have some thoughts about innovation as well? Or?
Well, he did. He thought that, you know, if you got a new machine, then you should reduce the... It was the pin factory, wasn't it?
I think so.
Yeah. So let's say you've got a pin factory and you get a new machine, and, you know, you've got 100 employees in the factory, and you get a new machine, and this machine allows you to make the same amount of pins, but in half the time. So Bertrand Russell said that, you know, a sort of kind society, as probably we would say, oh, this is great. You 100 workers, you've been working 50 hours a week. We've got this new machine. You only have to work 25 hours now. So you've got more time with your family. You've got more time to sort of for your own pursuits or creative pursuits. You've got more time for sport. You've got more time for church. You know, you've got more time for cooking and making things, building, looking after your home. All these important things, I think, you know, looking after yourself, looking after your soul, which is what philosophy is about. All these things need time. If we devote all our life to work, we haven't got enough time for other equally important stuff. So that doesn't happen. What they do is sack half the workers.
Or produce twice as many pins.
Yeah.
I was thinking, yeah, that's what I'd do.
Yeah, no, that was the, yeah, yeah. You were quite right, James. Yeah, yeah. No, but, this is great. We can make more pins. Then you might flood the market with pins. I mean, that's not the economist.
You'll put someone else out of business who's still got the old machine. I don't know, but there is a sort of relentlessness to competition. And
there is, and it's...
Capitalism, you know, isn't there, that is quite...
It's exciting.
Unforgiving in that respect, but also exciting.
It's brutal, but it's exciting. And but, you know, I think the idler, we're trying to say, yeah, that's all fine, but, you know, we need this other voice, the philosophical voice that's constantly saying, okay, but, you know, just slow down a bit, look after yourself.
All right. So, yeah, we're talking about entrepreneurs. You know, a lot of our listeners are entrepreneurs. And it occurs to me that for most entrepreneurs, the idea of idling might feel a bit alien. And, you know, do you think it's possible to be the CEO of a successful company and also an idler?
I think it is. I had a chat with Luke Johnson once, the entrepreneur, and he said he's very anti-idling. He's very, very hardworking.
He's been a guest on this podcast.
Well, he's amazing. I mean, he's done incredible things. You know, most famously probably Pizza Express. But it's, you know, it's quite a brutal world he's in. And he's got a lot of things on his plate, I suppose. So he does have to work hard. But I think, you know, CEOs could all slow down a bit because, as everyone knows from their own experience, you don't make good decisions when you're tired. You don't have good ideas when you're tired. You don't manage well when you're tired. You know, you slow down horribly and you can get quite sort of techy. So the CEO in particular needs to make sure that she or he is, you know, taking time off, taking a break, you know, going for walks. I don't know whether it's true, but there's some apocryphal story, you know, Warren Buffett takes every Friday off. I don't know, it's maybe not him, but it's someone like that, just to go for a walk and to think. And also, you know...
Couldn't he do that on Saturday?
you're busy catching up with your kind of domestic stuff.
Point taken. So you to clear your head and have some space.
To clear your head. Entrepreneurs are creative people, actually, aren't they? They have ideas.
Yeah, and it's a long game. I mean, it's a marathon, not a sprint, so you can't... You don't want to exhaust yourself or burn out. If there are any, what are the benefits for businesses of idling? I mean, is this a philosophy that you can apply to your company or organization usefully?
Yes, I think it is, because it's about, you know, keeping a distance from it. I mean, I know from my own personal experience, it's really hard. Victoria and I ran a bookshop for 5 years. I mean, that really was actually very hard work compared with what I've been doing before, which is writing books. And I was
so
going
selling to books is harder than writing them, is it?
Much harder.
Much harder.
Give respect to anyone in retail, because it's really hard. We had events in the evening. We were quite good at the events, but the actual everyday business of running a shop. And it was the idea was coffee house, like an 18th century coffee house, and bookseller. So you could come and have a coffee, buy books, talk about ideas, you know. But it didn't look like a bookshop. So people came in and just sat there all day and then left without buying a book or even buying a coffee. They thought it was like a library.
They were just idling. Why are you upset?
Just idling.
You've just been saying to us you should go and flop on a park bench. They just came into your shop and lived the dream, didn't they, Tom?
Yeah, I could have paid the rent on that, mate, and the staff.
You're now sounding like a capitalist.
Well, this is the thing. That's what that was the weird thing, the weird kind of mix. And I I tackled this in a book called Business for Bohemians, you know, because...
Yeah, tell me about that. What's that? That's sitting right behind you. Yeah. So tell me about that project. What was that about and why did you do it?
It was kind of a story about experiences running this small business bookshop and also trying to keep the magazine going and some publishing projects and a bit of consultancy that we did. Various things to try and make ends meet. And I realised that, you know, I suppose I'm a sort of creative type of person, not really naturally very sort of business-like. But if I want to avoid having a full-time job and make money out of my own business, then I needed to learn about business. You know, it's not something you just know. It's a skill in itself.
Yeah, so you realise that.
I realise that. So I'm going to try and teach myself, you know, but also want to help other people avoid the same mistakes that we'd made. And so the book is about all the different aspects of business, you know, pricing, marketing, spreadsheets, you know, how to sort of stay resilient. And, you know, I do talk about the Stoics in the book too, because they've got some useful advice for business people who are under stress, you know.
What's that?
Well, I think take you know, detach yourself from it. Yeah. Maybe it's not that important. There's this thing, catastrophizing.
Mm.
You've probably heard this word. It's like, oh my God, I have this going wrong. And I used to stand in the shop and go, what's the point? What's the point? All this hard work you put in. And then, you know, you have a whole day of kind of, and then no one comes in.
Yeah.
And that's to be avoided. So just to be one step detached. I suspect you're very good at this, James. And, you know, you can sort of step back from it, not allow it to kind of stress you out too much. And that probably comes with training, you know, but I found that quite difficult. So I got better at it. And then also things like just learning to be sensible with money. Also, how do you sell? They're all very, very difficult arts, I think. So, you know, I'm slightly cautious if I say to people, oh, well, quit your job and start your own business. You know, it's very difficult.
There's a lot involved. Well, I commend your book, Business for Bohemians, to people who want to do that, because
thanks.
I think it's got a lot of interesting and useful content, and it's from your own lived experience, isn't it?
It is. And James, you were very great. You came and gave talks
on how to recruit people. I remember doing that. Yeah, and so I think that's a good initiative. But is it possible to be to live that life? You know, to earn enough as a sort of bohemian, as you described it, you know, realistically. I mean, is this an avenue that people can in 2025?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, obviously, you're not going to be necessarily making sort of millions, or certainly not billions. Mm. If you want to do this thing, whatever it is, you know, and
monetize your hobby, perhaps.
Monetize your hobby. I mean, maybe it's a grandiose comparison, but you know, I remember interviewing Damien Hirst many, many years ago, and he said, "My business model is the Beatles." I thought that was a really good comment. You know, the Beatles, okay, they're a special case. You know, we can't...
Well, what does he mean by that?
What he meant was that they were enjoying themselves, doing what they wanted, but they were also very good at the sort of business side, and they were very kind of ambitious, you know. So I'm... Although this is all about idling, I'm also sort of quite ambitious. It's like John Lennon was... A lot of Beatles songs also are about the importance of idling. Seeing the wheels go around, imagine all the people, these kind of Stoic ideas.
But they... Work really hard, didn't they? I mean, they played for many years in clubs before they sort of...
And so, yeah, it's just...
But they love what they were doing.
And Paul McCartney had this phrase that we've had a hard day's play. So it's when play and work get sort of mixed up together.
That's the kind of sweet spot you're looking for.
That's the sort of sweet spot. And it's almost like it's a sort of vocation, really. But Victoria and I went through a period of being sort of quite skint, and that wasn't much fun at all. So... You've got to be sensible about the business as a business.
What do you say to your kids about idling? I mean, is this something you encourage, or is it something that makes you do your homework sort of thing? How do you approach that? I mean, I can imagine it being a little sensitive.
Yeah, I tried to hide the magazine when they were teenagers. But you,
did you?
But Dad, you say, you know, it's good to... Well, strangely, but my eldest son is really not very idle at all. I mean, he's sort of a tech bro. You know, he works for a tech company.
Right.
He works really hard and... He's always on his phone, and he thinks in a sort of tech way. And he's very hardworking, and he was actually worked quite hard when he was quite small. He used to run businesses and things.
So he's an entrepreneur.
He's an entrepreneur. He's got a job at
Shock
the moment.
Horror! I mean, what are you going to do? We've got this dynamo in the house.
But then he did see Victoria and I sort of slaving away, not slaving away, but you know, it was chosen, but going to festivals, you know.
Well, you grew up in a home where you were, entrepreneurial, I guess.
It was an I'm not saying successful entrepreneurial. That's my joke. It's like, I'm on James Reid's podcast. He interviews entrepreneurs and they don't have to be successful ones.
Well, no, I mean, you're an entrepreneur if you're running your own show. And
no, I think I think if you're more or less doing what you want to do and you're making a living, that is a success, yeah.
And I think that thing about, you know, having your time is your own, I think is important to a lot of entrepreneurs.
I think that is the great benefit. So, I mean, in one sense, I'm working all the time because I'm always thinking about the magazine, ideas for the magazine, little sentences in my head for bits of writing. It's kind of 24/7. But on the other hand, I can take Wednesday afternoon off and go and play tennis or go for a walk if I choose to. So personally, I really enjoy that sort of freedom. You know, I can quite often work, do 2 or 3 hours work on a Sunday morning at home writing or something, you know. But then, reserve the right to sort of, you know.
So I'd like just like to explore, you talked a bit about having this bookshop where she ran for a period of time and you found it tough. Give me some specifics for people who are listening who might be thinking of starting a business. What were the, say, three things that you felt, oh, I didn't realise that was coming towards me and I wish I'd known about it and I would have done it differently?
Yeah, well, staff.
So people.
Staff and people, tax and VAT.
Right, tax.
And accounting, that whole area.
Yeah, people, finance, accounting, tax.
And funding also, I would say, actually. I mean, I think we were quite good at coming up with the ideas and making things happen, booking people for events. And the events were good. We were quite good at publicity. We had got a lot of publicity.
But what about the people side of things? What did you find
hard
about that?
Well, the people side of things, it's, you know, we should have come to you, James, on day one because...
Thank you for saying that. I've been very happy to help you. But,
you know, I think recruiting people is, again, it's a skill in itself. You know,
it's very important to get it right.
We didn't know anything about it. You know, we were completely useless. We had no experience at all, really. I mean, I had worked with people at The Guardian, obviously, but I didn't have to interview people, employ people, and then work out, and then manage them really, you know, and then work out all their tax and everything and their contracts. And we had a lot of, you know, quite bad episodes with staff. And I found that very difficult. And also because it was called the Idler Academy, you know, it was difficult for me to kind of crack the whip if they were late or lazy. Yeah. I remember overhearing some staff saying, yeah, it's such a hypocrite, you know, we have to work really hard here.
So they'd been missold, do you think?
Yeah, it's got the wrong name. We should have called it the Hard Work Academy.
Yeah, I can see that might be. So, okay, so the people side of things.
So the staff thing, I think, yeah, that's really difficult.
But there's a statistic that really struck me that 80% of managers in Britain have had no formal training. So I suppose if you're starting your own business, you've had no formal training, you fall into that category.
Yeah, you do.
And makes it a lot harder.
It does, because you think, you don't realise it's a skill in itself, I think. It's like being a carpenter. I mean, I can't build a table. And I think I can manage a team of staff. Well, I couldn't. And you think, because I'm just a human being, oh, I'll just be nice to them. There's more to it than that, isn't there? Well, as you well know. And so that was a bit of a shock.
And talk me about
being a bad boss and being a bad manager.
Well, and so there's that. Then what you said, finance generally, what was the challenge there for you?
We didn't keep books properly. And this led to all sorts of really stressful problems with being late with VAT, tax issues. You know, we got like a really like a sort of five-figure VAT bill that I hadn't been expecting. And we were pretty hand-to-mouth in the business. So we didn't have
so
any...
So what did you do when that came?
I don't know. We just dug into the overdraft or we paid it in installments. So the amazing thing is that actually if you ring up the government... well, what I learned was the more you put your head in the sand, the worse it gets. If you got a problem, deal with it like instantly. And people are actually really nice. They're human beings at the other end. They don't want to destroy you, you know. And we found that once we faced up to it, it was okay that, you know, we'll put an installment plan in, you know, you can pay a certain amount per month, you know.
So that's good advice. Pick up the phone, talk to someone.
Pick up the phone and talk to someone.
Let them know you weren't expecting this or you need to make a plan to pay it.
You admit you made a mistake, you know, and rather than sort of, probably what I did at the beginning, just get angry. You know, get angry at, well, okay, Tom, don't get angry. You know, everyone else pays VAT and tax. You know, why do you think you're exempt from this? You should be exempt. Same with rent and rates and things like that, you know. So if you want to enter the system like this and start a business, well, you have to accept that there are kind of laws around it.
And get a good bookkeeper by the sound of things.
And that was the other thing. We did, our books were terrible. So that just caused a lot of chaos. We didn't, you know, we just about managed to keep up with everything. We had a good chartered accountant, so they were able to do our accounts each year, so that's fine. So we didn't miss the account deadline with Companies House. But the everyday accounts were a complete, everyday books were a complete mess. When we closed the shop and relaunched the business, the first thing we did was to employ a very, very good, you know, bookkeeper and financial manager.
Right.
Before I was doing it, and this person now will chase up invoices, you know, send our invoices out, and helps me to produce budgets, management accounts, and all these sorts of things that we were taught later. So I started to learn that stuff towards the end of our tenure at the bookshop. I should have learned that before. You know, we should have gone on some sort of proper business course or something.
Yeah, a good course is finance for non-financial managers and things like
that. Yeah, I just think there are things like that out there that they should be. I've actually put some on our website. Yeah.
No, that's really important. I can see that. And then you said funding was the third.
We didn't have enough money. So, I mean, the whole thing was a bit sort of foolish, really, because it wasn't really a very good business idea.
Only knew that later.
We only knew that later, although I was warned on before it started by Frank John Brown, who's...
He's a publisher.
He's a very successful publisher. He published Viz, yeah. He made absolute millions and, you know, lives in Holland Park and all the rest of it. But he's great. He's a great support and advice. He popped round, just before we'd opened the shop. It was too late to do anything. We'd already taken out a five-year lease.
All right.
And he said, well, what is it then? Well, it's the Idle Academy of Philosophy, Husbandry and Merriment, Bookseller and Coffee House. Bit of a long title. Okay, fine. But and what are you going to do? Well, I sort of stuttered, you know, we're going to have, during the day, it's a bookshop and a cafe and, you know, a sort of hangout place. And in the evening, we'll have talks, events, dancing, I don't know, you know, Latin lessons, grammar. And he said, I see. Midlife crisis center, marginal at best.
But you did do all of those things.
We did do all those things. And so there's something to be proud of.
You had a go. I mean, that's an important thing, isn't it? You had a go.
And on the plus side, I think
you learned some things along the way.
You learned some things along the way. Yeah. And you do get some respect for having a go. But the problem is, respect don't pay the rent.
No. So you moved on from bookshop and you now run an academy that's digital.
Yeah, this time we raised some money because I was saying that, you know, we never had quite enough money in the account. So it was always just a bit behind everything. And that's just really stressful, you know. Mm. And then we weren't paying ourselves. We paid ourselves less and less. By the end, we were paying ourselves nothing. So I was having to live off bits of journalism or I just borrow 10 quid out of the till, you know, to eat.
So this is tough. Yeah.
It was really tough, yeah. And we did other things like we bred puppies. I mean, we did all sorts of desperate things to try and make some money. But with the new iteration, I really dipped my toe sort of deeper into capitalism, if you like. Went to a company called Crowdcube, which a lot of your listeners will be aware of. And this actually worked quite well for us. I mean, I have some reservations about it, but it's a crowdfunding business.
Where people can invest in other businesses.
They invest. So it's not Kickstarter, so you're not selling stuff in advance. But you're actually
selling
shares.
You have a lot of shareholders now, I guess.
Yeah. So now we've got 150 shareholders. Right. We sold a percentage of the company, 11 to 12%, and we raised 150 grand. It was great. So that meant that we could, you know, quite comfortably hire an assistant, rent an office, and also have some money in the bank for marketing. That was one thing we did. And then the second thing was we got advice from, I think the other advice thing I've learned is if whatever it is you want to do, find someone who's done the same thing but successfully, and get advice from them, because you get a lot of advice. You're probably too successful, James, to experience this, but I find that when you're doing a small business, lots of friends, well-meaning friends, advise you. But as Luke Johnson would say, have they run a small business? Have they done something like you? If the answer is no, then there's not much point listening to their advice, really. But we went to another magazine called The Oldie, who we're good friends with, very similar sort of business. And they've advised us really well on how to run a small magazine that also does some other things.
So the Oldie advises the idea, yeah. Like an older sibling.
It really is. I like that. It's like Uncle Oldie.
Uncle Oldie's been helpful. That's good.
But they're helping out the idler.
So but looking for sort of fellow travellers who you can share.
Yeah, like a mentor, you know, someone who's done something very similar and knows what you're going through. So James at the Oldie, the publisher, you know, they also run holidays. They sell subscriptions to a magazine. They sell advertising. It's just a very, very similar.
But you're not competing.
We're not competing at all. We've both got quite quirky titles, and so that's been really good to learn from them.
Right, right. So the business is on a new basis now. Then you've been financed. You're doing digital. You've got your academy going. You're doing these trips as well.
Yeah.
So so if someone wants to subscribe or come on one of your trips, tell us about one of these trips so that people know what's on offer here, and then tell us how they can find them.
Well, thanks, James. Yeah, we call them Idler Retreats. And in the modern lingo, I suppose you would call them experiences. We started doing them actually when Victoria and I were living in a farmhouse in North Devon. Short weekends for people to come and sort of experience a bit of country life, you know, vegetable growing, beekeeping, these things that we were doing then. And the retreats, but then a few years ago, we found a really wonderful villa in Italy called Villa Pier. And we've now done a lot of retreats with them. We take a group of sort of 20 to 30 Idler readers for a week. And there'll be some sort of a theme. We'll go and visit churches, Piero della Francesca, Renaissance art, Siena, Arezzo. The last one was a pilgrimage theme. So it was all about St. Francis. And we retraced his steps on three separate days on short walks, or medium walks, 7 miles, and ended up in Assisi on the last one. And then I'll be giving talks about, you know, idling or philosophy. We took a group to Spain, to Andalusia recently. And, you know, it's a mix of philosophical thinking, good chat, good fun evenings, sing-alongs. We all eat together, so there's a sort of feasting element. So the sort of merrymaking is a part of it, but it's also very educational. I think people really enjoy learning, you know. Right.
So you have sing-alongs?
We always have a sing-along at the end.
Okay, so if someone wants to come on one of these retreats, where do they go? How do they find you?
They go to idler.co.uk.
Idler.co.uk.
Yeah. And the thing people love about them as well is that, you know, you just meet so many interesting people.
Well, I know you do beekeeping courses. They're very good because my wife Nicola's
They are brilliant experiences.
But they are. And so many people have learned beekeeping.
They're good, aren't they? Which
is a good thing.
Yeah.
Well, congratulations on, I guess, pivoting and reinventing your business. Are there any other lessons you want to share to entrepreneurs or would-be entrepreneurs from your journey so far?
Well, I think there's the flip side to idling, going back to why CEOs should be more idle, which is efficiency. So it's all about not wasting your time. And I think an efficient ethic is better than a sort of work ethic. So, you know, long hours don't necessarily produce better results. Or, you know, sort of more productivity. They might do in some industries, but, you know, in general, they're not necessarily linked. So I think the sort of arts of efficiency need to be studied. And perhaps the person who sort of, you know, leaves on time should be more respected than the person who kind of lingers for 2 or 3 hours after whatever the home time is, just to be seen to be sort of working harder or something like that, you know. So I think that's one of the lessons is efficiency is the kind of another way of saying, you know, I don't work too hard. I guess, you know, I work efficiently and I enjoy it, but I'm not going to sort of kill myself. I think that's an important lesson for anybody. And also to find, as I said at the beginning, to find these little bits of time during the day when you just let your mind wander and drift and turn the phone off, put the phone away, sit on a park bench, as we talked about at the beginning. There's, you know, idling is free. So one of the main criticisms we get and have always had is, you probably need to be rich to be an idler. Oh, well, it's all right for you sort of posh people. We have a festival in Hampstead and we do ukulele teaching. And someone once got angry and sent me an email saying, you know, it's all right for you and your posh mates playing the ukulele in Hampstead. Well, that was really
what's
funny.
Your answer to that? Because, I mean, there is a bit of that. You must get, you know.
Yeah, it seems a bit silly. Well, the answer to that is no.
It's a la-di-da lifestyle.
It's like, oh, well, you know, like,
You're saying you're saying you're sort of financing this from your endeavours.
Yeah, and I'm saying, you know, we don't have any private income or anything like that. You know, it's all self-financed. It's for buying and selling, you know, from selling things, making things and selling them, like the Beatles. the idea of the idle rich. No, you know, idling is free. Anyone can be idle. It's a question of taking control of your time and sort of, you know, being a bit kind of thinking smart, as they say in America, about your time, organising it carefully. And also, I think, actually scheduling idling nowadays.
All right. So I asked you right at the beginning, is idling the same as being lazy? So and you said it was not. And I suppose sort of to summarise what I've heard, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, the sort of upsides of idling, if you're an entrepreneur or someone who's probably quite driven, one, you might make yourself more efficient by managing your time more carefully and in a more focused way,
yeah,
you might have better ideas, because ideas come often in this sort of less likely situations where you might be idling. And I suppose I'm sort of underlying all this, you might have better relationships as well, because you have time for other people. And is that a fair summary of the?
I think that's right.
Can we reconcile our positions here?
Yeah, we can, because you could do your job better if you have a bit more idling. I mean, there was one example was is doctors. You know, I've met quite a few doctors who've gone down to a 4-day week. Well, they feel they can give a better service to their patients because they're enjoying it. They're not exhausted, you know.
As long as you don't get sick on one of their days off. That's what I worry about.
That's fallible logic, James, because there's a bunch of them. You share the work, you know. So, yeah, you don't all take the same day off. That's what someone objected to. I think it was Jacob Rees-Mogg objected to the 4-day week in Cambridge Council. He said, well, what happens if, you know, there's a pothole leaves filling on a Friday? It doesn't work like that, you know. Like, not everyone, the entire department doesn't all take Friday off, you know.
Are you sure about that? Some people might wonder. I mean, Fridays have become a bit of a fall guy for some of this stuff. I notice the productivity takes a hit there. Yeah,
some of this is sacrilegious. Love Fridays.
I think you should love every day. But
love every day, that's exactly right.
Are you a fan of the 4-day week?
Well, I mean, I don't do it personally because it's just all sort of spread out. But I am, you know, anything that's moving forward to giving people more leisure, yes, I'm a fan of it. So, but I don't think it should be imposed on people.
So AI, you should love that. I mean, that's going to give people a lot more leisure, isn't it?
I don't know whether it will. We just don't know. Like I said, it tends not to happen with labour-saving devices. You think they're going to give people more leisure, and they somehow don't. They just sort of...
Windmills were meant to give people more leisure.
Windmills. People were scared of windmills at the time. They thought they were a bit like we're scared of AI, but they were scared of windmills. They thought they were sort of like ungodly creatures, ungodly machines, harvesting, you know, the air.
Yeah, well, they were a new innovation, weren't they? All right. So, well, thank you for coming to talk to me.
Thank you.
And thank you for your words of wisdom. I mean, it's good to hear some philosophy on the podcast and go back to Stoicism and Athens. And one other thing, I remember you telling me on another occasion, the origins of the word scholar or school.
Yeah.
But just share that at the end of this podcast, because I think that's really interesting.
Yeah, I found this out quite recently. We were talking about the ancient Greek philosophers, and they argued that everyone should make, you know, give themselves more leisure time to do more philosophizing, you know, to take care of their soul, take care of their body, take care of their friendships, take care of their life, not just work. And their word for that was skole, leisure. So skole was the ancient Greek word for leisure. It's when you did what you wanted, when you were released to do what you wanted to do, not things that you sort of had to or were forced to for whatever reason. So it meant kind of freedom, but it turned into the word, Latin word for school, scholus, because school was what, again, the beginning of school, it was something kind of fun, you know, that you did because you wanted to go and school yourself. So that's kind of what idling was about in our Idling Academy, like in your spare time, make more leisure time to educate yourself, to enjoy your life more. So that's an amazing idea that this word, you know, which now, to us, the word school sounds like something that's actually imposed on you that you sort of don't like. Originally was a word meaning the kind of stuff that you would do for fun in your leisure time.
So back to school for learning in
back
leisure.
To scholae.
Yeah, scholae. I like that thought. Thanks so much for coming to talk to me, Tom. It's been a real pleasure. I'm going to ask you two questions at the end that I ask all my guests. The first one is, you know, the clues on the wall. You know, what is it that gets you up on a Monday morning?
Well, I think idling, as we said, it doesn't mean not working. It means enjoying the work you're doing. And I actually look forward to, cause you're right, you know, if you can go, the sign of a happy life must be something like, do you go to bed on a Sunday evening looking forward to getting up the next day? You know, I've had lots of periods when I really didn't, that really, you know, and if that's happening, then I think that's the sign you need to change your life. And that might be in getting another job, finding a different position, changing your arrangement in some way or other, but you need to make that effort to do it. And for me personally, I look forward to Monday mornings because that's, in general, that's my sort of writing time. So that's the time when I can sit down at home and read my Stoic philosophers or whatever it is and write articles, continue work on my next book. My next book is about Socrates, so I enjoy that. And I think that's almost, it almost feels like a skive. Because that's the morning I give off my idler stuff.
So when's your Stoic book coming out?
That's coming out in February 2026.
And what's it going to be called, do you know?
It's called How to Live Like a Stoic.
Okay, by Tom Hodgkinson. We'll look out for that. So that's your Monday morning. That's covered Socrates next. So you're pretty busy on Mondays. Yeah. But I completely agree with what you say. If you're not looking forward to Monday, then it's time to make a change. We're Absolutely. Here to help, but yeah. so are you with your philosophy.
Yeah.
And then the last question is, where do you see yourself in 5 years' time?
Well, I think I've mentioned, although, you know, I think idlers can be quite ambitious. So often people who are entrepreneurs are people who might have been quite lazy when they were at school or quite lazy when they had a sort of more conventional job because they had, it's a kind of, so laziness can be a sort of a sign of the free spirit, I think, sort of rebelling against an authority or being told what to do. And an alternative to that is to become an entrepreneur. And I think that's quite common with entrepreneurs. There's something maybe slightly wrong with them often. They don't quite sort of fit in. I mean, you know, Richard Branson is famously dyslexic and he's got a slightly different way of looking at things. What was the question?
Where do you see yourself in 5 years' time?
Oh,
I've
been weaving again, yeah. Sorry.
That's good, carry on. I'm enjoying the ramble.
Okay, right, so like, where do I see myself? That's my main, one of my big problems, talk too much.
But you can't see yourself in 5 years' time. Yeah,
in 5 years' time, I see myself keep my mouth shut a lot more often. No, I think doing the same thing, but with more readers. You know, we're quite ambitious for The Idler. We'd like to be doing more trips, spreading the word more widely. More subscriptions, like a band. A band wants more fans, you know.
Carry on idling, yeah.
So I'm really happy with the everyday work I'm doing. I don't feel like I want to retire or anything. I'll probably never retire because it's really quite fun. And journalists generally say, well, journalism is not really work. It's sort of fun, you know. So for me, it's all fun, you know. So hopefully just carry on. Hopefully we'll survive. That's an achievement. But also grow the business so that we have, you know, we have 5,000 subscribers. The circulation is 8,000 or 9,000. Well, yeah, we'd like to be on 10,000 subscribers and a circulation of 20,000. You know, the older you have a circulation of about 40,000. That's, you know, quite a successful magazine. So sort of keep spreading the idle word.
Good. Well, I wish you every success with that. And I hope praise from John Brown in the future. He sounds like a tough mentor. Thank you, Tom. Very good talking to you.
Thanks.
Thank you, Tom, for joining me on All About Business. I'm your host, James Reed, Chairman and CEO of Reed, a family-run recruitment and philanthropy company. If you'd like to find out more about Reed, Tom, and The Idler, all links are in the show notes. And if you liked this episode and would like to listen to more, please click on the follow button. See you next time.